Our next speaker is Mr. Mick Wallace.
Madness.
This is madness.
We cannot fix a problem caused by capitalism with more capitalism.
They hurt the people.
I ended up at the end of a gun
on three occasions.
I done well to survive anyway.
Madame Deli will speak.
A union which allows fiscal rules to be broken for arms expenditure,
but not for housing or to put roofs over the heads of people.
This is evidence of police violence. Whether you're an economic migrant or you're an asylum seeker, nobody deserves to be treated like this.
And even having the neck to suggest separating people from their mothers. How dare you?
They don't need us to kick them around the place.
You could say it, so what?
This is a
police
joke.
In riot gear with Trump. I am ashamed to call myself a European.
The recognition of Guaido, unelected gobshite, is an absolute embarrassment.
Now, you did use the word gobshite, and I would reprimand you over that.
Hello and welcome back to our fourth episode of I Foresee Trouble with Daly and Wallace. This is the podcast where we have conversations about what's really happening in the EU and bring you to the belly of the beast. I am Damian Thompson, your host again for today. And with the two honourable members of the European Parliament, we have Miss Honourable Member Claire Daly and the most honourable member, Mick Wallace. How are you both today? How are you getting on?
So still alive.
Yeah. So today's episode is about none other than COVID-19. We'll be talking about solidarity inside and out. And we're going to look at two angles on coronavirus that are probably less talked about. And the two of you have been championing this and bringing this up to the forefront in recent weeks. We're talking about the role of international sanctions and also the situation on the Greek islands for refugees. But before we delve into this, Mick, you were speaking in the hemicycle yesterday. We had a little plenary session. We had one debate. It was on the coronavirus. You had a one-minute speech and you made a good few damning points towards President of the Commission, Ursula von der Leyen. So let's just have a little listen to what you said first.
Grazie, Presidente. Medical staff all across Europe have been the heroes of this crisis. But a report published last month found that European Commission made at least 63 demands of member states to cut spending on healthcare provision from 2011 to 2018 to meet the arbitrary debt and deficit targets of the Stability and Growth Pact. These rules have hollowed out public services across Europe, including health services. The President said that the Stability and Growth Pact and state aid rules will be relaxed, but they should be abolished for good. Commission proposes to use 37 billion drawn from various funds. But these funds and projects will be needed more than ever when the crisis ends. Crisis will cost Ireland at least 15 billion. Will the citizens of Ireland be paying for it for years to come? You've printed money for the banks. Will you print it for the people? President von der Leyen said the Commission will mobilise all existing budget resources. So will you reallocate military spending to fight COVID-19? The President said we must help each other. She said history is looking at us. Well, history will damn our lack of solidarity. Italia got more solidarity from China and Cuba than it got from Europe. It will damn us for failing to do enough to challenge US sanctions against countries like Iran and Venezuela. We've condemned them to die. Capitalism has failed the people. We cannot go back to where we were.
So history will damn our lack of solidarity, Mick. What's that meant to mean?
Well, I think even von der Leyen yesterday actually touched on it herself and said that there could have been greater solidarity from the word go. Italy complained very strongly about the lack of solidarity, especially in the early stages. And there was even the Italians, the foreign minister, told us that Italy had asked to activate the European Union mechanism of civil protection for the supply of medical equipment for individual protection. But unfortunately, not a single EU country responded to the Commission's call. Only China responded bilaterally. Certainly, it's hardly a good sign of European solidarity, according to Maurizio Mazzari, the Italian permanent representative of the European Union. They were far from impressed. And now, since I made that statement yesterday, the Commission has gone into overdrive to tell us that France and Germany together, combined, are now giving more equipment and supplies to Italy than the Chinese gave. Now, well, come on. Well, first of all, they're combined. It didn't say that one of them was given more than the Chinese. So we can take it that the Chinese gave more than each of them, have still given them more than each of them. Right? And also, they're talking about masks.
Yeah.
I didn't hear any word about respirators, which are costing an absolute fortune and that Italy was in dire need of. But look, I'm sure the Europeans are helping in some form, but... At an early stage, the Italians were directly looking for help, and it was very slow to come. And people say, "Oh well, I mean, I see the High Representative Joseph Borrell. He's actually been critical of the Chinese because of the PR games they're playing, and that you know, oh, this they're trying to ingratiate themselves with Europeans." Well, yeah, I'm sure they are trying to develop good relations. And people probably should remember that Italy were the only European country of note that signed the Belt and Road Initiative, which is the new Silk Road coming from Iran all the way to Italy. Mm. And so Italy already has been developing its relationships with China. And, yeah, I mean, of course... for China seems to be offering help to many, many countries around the world now. And to say, oh, well, you're only doing that because you want to promote yourselves. Well, I'll tell you what, I'd still say thanks.
So you did seem to provoke quite a reaction. We had the assistant of the Secretary General of the Commission quickly getting on Twitter to get a few of their facts straight. They're saying 1.5 million masks from Austria to Italy, a million masks from France, million masks from Germany, whatever. You made this point of the respirators as well, not being a core part of this solidarity. Claire, what do you make of this action? Is it too little too late? Or
yeah, and I think that was the feature of the discussion in the plenary yesterday. I mean, we had this weird plenary where there was maybe 40 of us present yesterday with mandatory sort of gaps between us all and with other MEPs voting from home. But I think the mood was kind of mixed. There was a lot of protesting too much, I thought, of clapping each other on the back about how great the European Union was, but a recognition that in the earlier days the response was to put the boundaries up, to leave the country who were hardest hit, and that only latterly try and catch up. So this is going to go on. Yeah. Anyway, the fallout's going to be immense for the European Union because they have been caught lacking. And she tried to persuade us that, oh, they were investing in, you know, medical research now and protective gear, and we were getting the show on the road and the goods would be travelling. But, you know, their borders have been put up in a lot of areas as well. And we have six member states who have said they're opting out of the European Convention on Human Rights to deal with the crisis as well, which is not the solution either.
Yeah, so we're going to get to that as well, but later, about what is kind of covering up. We have von der Leyen tweeted yesterday or the other day saying that respiratory ventilators can save lives and we need to ensure we have enough in the EU. I called a video conference with CEOs of 25 countries to discuss with them the ramping up of their production. This is the 25th of March. She's saying that she had a phone call with a few CEOs. What is this about? What is it really... timely measures, or what
look,
should we be expecting from the Commission?
Far they're behind. I mean, they put in 80 plus million now into CureVac, which is a European German based company, private company, in order to kind of work on the cure. Now, I know the CEO of that company has said, oh, if they discover a cure, that it will be dealt with properly, that they won't, you know, keep the rights and exploit it. But doesn't it say a lot for European sort of research and development that all of it is spearheaded by the private sector? And what we've seen is the private sector being caught out, really, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I was actually surprised to hear von der Leyen come out as strongly as she did. I mean, listen, we're very conscious of the fact that she's German, she's very conservative, she's right-wing, she's very much in favour of the militarisation of Europe.
Defence Minister in Germany.
Yeah, and she's very, very neoliberal. And we've been pointing out since we came over here last summer, this place has developed into a bit of a neoliberal club. And neoliberalism is enshrined in how the EU operates. And the problems of coronavirus have exposed that. And this reliance on the private sector all the time to do everything. And the private sector have... working in this area, you can be assured that they will absolutely reef everybody with price, because they're in such a privileged position. But it was interesting to hear Van der Leyen yesterday say that she rebuked member states for looking out for themselves during the early phases of the crisis. And she says, when Europe really needed an all-for-one spirit, too many initially gave an only-for-me response. And when Europe really needed to prove that this is not only a fair-weather union, too many initially refused to share their umbrella. And she was actually hitting at the Germans there as well, because the Germans, when at one stage, very early on, when the Italians were looking for some equipment from the Germans says, sorry, we need it for ourselves. And I mean, and Italy was starting to fall apart.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, this will not be forgotten. And the help that China and Cuba and even Russia have given the Italians, I can tell you from speaking to Italians, they won't forget it too easily either. Mm-hmm. But another big factor now, and it was coming up yesterday as well and the day before, was this talk now of corona bonds. Because the Italians are adamant that Europe must... It's not enough to give us to give these countries like Italy and Ireland money to pay for the crisis, and then make them put the debt on the people for several years afterwards. But that's what happened with the crisis in 2008. The Irish people faced austerity for over 6 years because of the effort to repay that money. Mm-hmm. But yet, we've seen it, and I raised it in my speech yesterday as well. Yet, whenever financial institutions get into trouble, they don't seem to have any money, they don't seem to have any problem printing money for them. This idea of corona bonds now, and there's huge support for it. It isn't just the Italians. They were supported by Spain, Portugal, France, Ireland, Belgium, Luxembourg, Slovenia and Greece. And, I mean, this is 9 powerful countries in the EU that can actually, it can shake the attitude and approach that's prevailed too long in Europe, where they have a whole different set of rules for big business and financial institutions, and a different set altogether for the people. This is a time to change things. And I mean, when this already, I mean, these corona bonds are being called a European recovery bond, right? Already, Germany, Austria, and the Netherlands, the three of the wealthiest countries in the EU, are already opposing it. Mm-hmm. Now, I tell you what, if the European project is going to survive, if it has any future, it has to help countries like Ireland and Italy and Spain and Portugal and France. It has to help them to deal financially with this problem, or the aftermath will be terrible for the people living in those countries for too long.
So another point then, Mick, that you brought up in your speech, which probably surprises a few people at home, because they're wondering, why are you talking about sanctions and when you have 1 minute to talk about coronavirus? A few people will be scratching their heads, but you've been making this link very clear about why we need to have this conversation on international sanctions against countries that are struggling to cope now with COVID. Can you explain a bit more, why is this such an important aspect of this debate?
Well, yeah, listen, I mean, I suppose we've always been of the philosophy that everything is connected. And even often at home, we'd get attacked and criticised for talking about things away from the island of Ireland. But I mean, it's a bit like getting criticised in Wexford for not doing Parish Pump, when in actual fact, the decisions about Wexford are actually made in Dublin. They're made at national level. But likewise, an awful lot of the decisions that affect Ireland now are being made in Europe. And likewise, everything that affects Europe, right, it's a global world. And what's what happens outside of Europe is significant for Europe. So, and in terms of coronavirus, I mean, the virus doesn't have any respect or recognition for borders. It jumps borders pretty handily. There's no border could have kept the coronavirus out of a country. And when it happened in China, we probably didn't take it on board quickly enough. And we were a bit slow to actually react. We're also a bit slow to listen to the Chinese. But you then have, I mean, with regard to the sanctions, if people are dying in Iran because of sanctions, where they're not getting enough equipment and medicine to deal with the crisis and to save their own people, if the virus then is spreading quicker in Iran than it needs spread,
yeah.
Well, I mean, it doesn't just stop there. It goes outside of Iran's borders too. And the whole notion that that we should be oblivious to what's happening to the Iranians is just not acceptable at all. And also, if we're going to care about humanity, we don't just care about our own. We care about everybody. It all matters.
Yeah.
I mean, Mick touched on two points there. They're very important. Obviously, this is a borderless pandemic, which means that the public health of citizens in Iran is also an impact to us. But, you know, this is a humanitarian issue. And the Iranian ambassador to Ireland wrote to the Taoiseach recently and made the point that the Irish people remember even now the impact of the famine, where our people literally starved and died when they shouldn't have. That's the scenario now that's facing the Iranian people. They've highly qualified medical staff. They have a good organised society there, but they can't access basic medical equipment to combat the virus. And as a result, people are dying. Like, they've already had over 2,000 people dead. And the causes of the reason why they can't treat their own people is illegal US sanctions in breach of international law. And the idea that the international community would stay silent in the face of what is virtually genocide is actually horrific. And we saw the Americans even using the crisis to talk about ratcheting up the war in Iran, almost taking glee in what is now the organised murder nearly of Iranian citizens. And that has a knock-on effect in nearby Afghanistan and other areas as well, because we've seen now hundreds of thousands of Afghanis who've been refugees in Iran leaving, coming back to Afghanistan, where that broken society is incapable of dealing with the people there. So it's a huge crisis. And I think it's really sickening that the European Union has done nothing on this. We had the foreign minister of Iran also wrote to the European Parliament asking Europe to speak up and do something and have these sanctions lifted in accordance with international law and to bring forward and, you know, get the Iranians the medical help they need. And they have been silent. It's horrific. It really is.
Yeah. Only yesterday I was listening to Alfred Azayas. He's a former UN special rapporteur, and he was being asked about the latest sanctions, because there was actually further sanctions imposed on Iran only this week. And he says that the notion that in the midst of this pandemic of coronavirus, the Trump administration announcing new sanctions on Iran, he says, well, it's not only is it insane, he says it's a crime against humanity. And it could even be a form of genocide, depending on the number of victims that will be generated directly through these sanctions. And he said, really, he says, this is a moment in which we need a word from the UN General Assembly, from the international community, from the International Court of Justice, clearly stating that unilateral force of measures kill people. And these measures, this kind of hybrid warfare, this kind of non-conventional warfare, is incompatible with the United Nations Charter, and it has dire human consequences. And he says it also has a component of penal law. And he says the International Criminal Court has to take it up also in the case of the likes of Venezuela and Nicaragua and Syria. I mean, just there's there's no logic to this. And he says, it's not just a crime against humanity. He says, but if you read Article 7 of the Rome Statute, you'll see that because of the deliberateness of it, because of the impact that it has had already on some of these countries, it has already gone beyond the threshold of just a mere violation of international law and may reach the level of genocide. He says Article 2 of the Genocide Convention of 1948 states that if a country has a policy that has as its goal the decimation of a people, an ethnic group or a religious group or whatever, that constitutes genocide. And the real shock about all this is that Europe has been complicit by its silence on the US behaviour. Only this week, I think it was yesterday, the Iranian ambassador in Dublin wrote to Simon Coveney, our foreign minister, and pleaded with him for humanity to be respected. And it would be great if the Irish foreign minister had the courage to actually look at what's happening to Iran and say it clearly and boldly without fear of the Americans. Say it clearly, this is 100% wrong. This is inhuman and it's illegal.
Mm. And this crisis is really putting the spotlight on the cruelty of the sanctions, because these aren't new sanctions. They've been there for a long time now. But really, it's quite magnifying the impact of it. We have 27,000 confirmed cases in Iran, over 2,000 dead, and these numbers are conservative. But maybe if you just explain a bit about what these, you're talking about the intent of and the intention behind these sanctions, but what about the sanctions themselves? They're quite elaborate. They're from the US. They're not just direct sanctions that we're not selling things to Iran. Can you explain how it impacts and debilitates Iran's capacity to be able to respond to COVID-19?
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose, first of all, these are called third-rate sanctions, right? What happens is, you see, it's all very well for America to say, we won't sell you this, we won't sell you that, you can't sell this to us, you can't sell that to us. And they can introduce sanctions. And that's fine. States can do that. But what's happening of late is that the Americans, with their huge control over the financial system in the world, they are able to bully other countries into following their sanctions and saying, and the Americans say, if any company has anything to do with Iran, and if any company doesn't respect our sanctions against Iran, we will fine you for it. Because there's such, the Americans have their fingers in every financial pie on the planet. It is very, very hard for institutions to work without the American blessing.
Yeah.
And this is where they're having such an incredible effect. I mean, the Iranians are being prevented from selling their oil in order to raise revenue. The Iranians are being prevented from carrying out financial transactions with most of the banks. They can't buy... I mean, the Iranians make a lot of stuff themselves, but not everything. And there's a whole lot of things they need. And the Americans know what they need. And the Americans are going after, they're targeting the population. I mean, people used to talk about sanctions. I mean, I got a reply on Venezuela from the commission there about a month ago saying, oh, our sanctions are very targeted and they're only targeting individuals. They don't target the people. But obviously, that's all very well if it's true. But in actual fact, it's having a terrible impact on the people of Venezuela. Well, likewise, the sanctions are, I would argue that the Americans are hell-bent on bringing the whole of Iranian country to its knees. And the Americans have had no problem admitting that their long-term goal is regime change, because they want American-friendly government in place in order to facilitate Americans' interests, particularly financial interests. Right? And only this week, when Trump increased the sanctions, the Democratic Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut, he was interviewed. And he says, what do you think of Trump's new sanctions? And he says, this is madness, he said. He says, sanctions are not working. He says, Iran is still doing everything it does. He accused them of supporting the Houthis in Yemen, the Hezbollah, and working away in Syria. He accused them of continuing to build towards having their own nuclear power. He says, so the sanctions are not working. And he says, we want a regime. We want regime change, he says. I want it too, he says. We want a US friendly government there. But he says, how are we going to make it happen? We have to have the people on our side, he says, in Iran, not against us. He says, we are making them hate us because we are crucifying them. He says, this can't be the way forward and it doesn't make any sense. And it's really interesting, given with the American elections going on at the moment and what's been happening. But the Democrats and the Republicans have got so alike now that they're almost indistinguishable. And in 2017, when Trump introduced his first wave of sanctions during his term of office in 2017, the only Democrat that voted against him was Bernie Sanders, the guy who has just been shafted by the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party would rather have Trump in power than Sanders, because even though he'd only be considered mildly progressive in Europe.
Absolutely. These are the new forms of warfare. And as you said, like,
yes, we have to keep coming back to the point that they're only getting away with it because organisations and countries like the European Union allow them to do so. Because in fairness to the Iranian foreign minister, in his communication to the parliament here, he made the point that even before the coronavirus, the complicity of the EU in not having the backbone to stand up to the American sanctions has meant that imports of all medical goods to Iran were already down to less than 75% of what they were before the JCPOA. So that's absolutely criminal, and they have allowed that to happen. And what is needed now in the face of a massive humanitarian crisis is for them to stand up and give the support that's badly needed.
Yeah, like medical devices, pharmaceuticals, these are highly targeted by sanctions in the end of the day. That's the net effect.
Well, I mean, the International Court of Justice in 2018 told them that they had to lift the sanctions for humanitarian trade, recognising that, in essence, the people are suffering. The Iranians gave the example of the closure of European airports to Iran Air just before the crisis broke out, because the sanctions meant they were prevented from purchasing up-to-date flight planning software and so on, leaving thousands of Iranians stranded, if you like, in Europe. So it's shocking when you consider as well in the refugee context, the lap over with the amount of refugees who've been living in Iran, and that some of them are returning home. It means that entire region now is going to pay a heavy price, both in terms of human lives and in terms of the disruption of the area because of illegal US sanctions. And I mean, it's incredible. I mean, people are legally in prison at the moment, and they're being let out by governments all over the world because they recognise that public health comes first. Here we have illegal sanctions and they're still not lifting them and people are dying. Yeah. It is definitely the new form of warfare, and it is sickening and more harmful than dropping bombs at this stage.
It was interesting. People probably have forgotten it now, but the siege of Leningrad, which took place roughly between 1941 and 44 by the Nazis, it cost between 800,000 and 1 million lives. And it was actually declared a crime against humanity by the Nuremberg judgment, and rightly so. And there's crimes against humanity happening as we speak in countries that are at this receiving end of American sanctions. And the truth is that Trump is actually implying methods that we've seen the Nazis do it in the past, but he's implying methods that are criminal and they contradict the Nuremberg judgment. The American chief prosecutor in Nuremberg is a fellow called Robert Jackson, and in his opening speech in Nuremberg and in the course of the trial several times, he said that the trial only has legal and historical importance when we apply the same principles to ourselves. That was his core philosophy right through the Nuremberg trials. And he says that's what international law is. The principles that you apply to others, you must apply them to yourself. That is not what's happening in the world today. And Europe must carry a huge responsibility, because Europe is probably the entity with the most potential to actually call America to task and to put manners on them, but it's failing to do so. And I have to say that the High Representative, Joseph Borrell, has been a huge disappointment to me so far. Mm. Whether he changes remains to be seen.
And I want to ask you about that, because you've both been here since June. You've brought up the issue of sanctions multiple times, directly to the Commissioner, directly to the President of the Commission. On every occasion possible, really, what's the best you've gotten from them? Do they justify a radio silence, or do they very much show their complicity? What's the response?
Yeah, I mean, look, they kind of say, oh, it's targeted. We're not disrupting the, you know, the it's for a... I don't think... The responses have been ridiculous. I mean, we were kind of remarking there's been an email chain of correspondence between MEPs over the past while on this, which was even embarrassing, that in the midst of all of this, they're looking for even more targeted sanctions against some people. So, I mean, from the Commission's point of view, I suppose they're getting different viewpoints across the panel and across the chamber, and they're responding to them. But no, they're fully complicit, they really, and it's nearly as much their fault because of their silence. But no, we haven't got any decent answers.
So you're both keeping the pressure on anyway.
Yeah, I mean, the decision by the Commission and Joseph Borrell, as at one stage in the early days, we actually thought Borrell was going to be good on Venezuela. He seemed to have more of a feel for it there than he had in other troubled areas. But he has ended up actually recognising Guaido. Guaido. I mean, this is the greatest joke of all time. It's just so nonsensical. It's just
terrible. Well, I'd say he has a battle with the other commissioners as well, though. I mean, I'd say while doing that, and that was obviously reprehensible, at the same time, I would imagine he's battling some incredibly even worse hawks on the other side who are so poisonous against the Venezuelan government that even if he was their biggest champion, he'd have a hard job to convince.
And of course, very embarrassing. Oh, yeah. The parliament has even endorsed Guaido.
They're unreal. Yeah. Like, the throwbacks who are here now, some ultra right wingers here. Should we have the father of Leopoldo Lopez, the head of the Tug opposition here, who lobbies for them, and the Venezuelan opposition have their spokespeople here as well. So he has to listen to that too, you know.
I mean, just to give you an idea of where they're coming from, if you remember, when the Iraqi parliament, after the assassination of Soleimani by the Americans, Iraq held an emergency parliamentary session, and they voted unanimously to ask the Americans to leave now. Mm. And the Americans, of course, are refusing to go. But there was a commissioner come in to the department, to the Committee on Foreign Affairs, and I put it to her. I said, do you not think that there's unlikely to be peace in Iraq until the Americans and their supporting friends in Europe, until they all get out of the place and let Iraq sort out Iraq's problems? I said, do you not think that the Americans should go now? And she says, no, absolutely not. They should stay there. Now, give me a break.
Yeah, but that's a striking feature of everything that we've come across since we've come out here. I mean, a huge amount of time of the parliament is spent on dealing with refugees, or the migration crisis, as they call it. But there's practically no joined up thinking into the reasons why people are made refugees in the first place, and the European Union and the United States' role in that, in terms of the constant regime change efforts that are going on around the globe and the fallout from that. That, and of course environmental destruction and that as well, that they don't join the dots on that. And I think that's something that is probably going to remain with us during our term here. I think that's the battle that we're going to have to be fighting the most, because really that's where the input should be put in, into the reasons everybody should be able to live peaceably in their own home. They shouldn't have to leave. They're more than welcome to leave if they want and travel wherever, but they shouldn't have to. And that's the flip.
And that's it. We have international law being flouted left, right and centre here with the sanctions, but then also we see the Geneva Convention being completely ripped to pieces, essentially.
They do it here, like. They do it in Europe itself, so they're...
So let's talk then about this, the situation on the Greek islands, because this is an important issue as well when we're talking about COVID-19. We have highly congested islands. We have, 30,000 people, 20,000 people stuck in a camp that's designed for 3,000.
Over 40,000 on the islands, yeah. And then...
Yeah, so there's the prevention of COVID outbreak in the hotspots of Greek islands is an urgent necessity. Claire and Mick, both of you have written a letter or been part of a letter of 100 MEPs to the Commission recently. What was it saying about this?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, this issue is it's not new and we've discussed it here before. Sadly, it's got way worse. The first thing to say is that the problems on the island predate the COVID-19 crisis, but the consequence of COVID on that, on the islanders, is going to be absolutely immense now. So it's really frightening. We have decisions being taken by the Greek government over a month ago, which basically suspended the right to asylum. And now they are retrospectively trying to, I suppose, legitimise that and hide it under COVID. Say, oh, we're doing this now to protect public health. How can you protect public health on islands where there are 6 ICU beds for islanders as well as all of the refugees who are there? No chance of isolation, no chance of social segregation. And instead of a humanitarian response to the crisis, what they've done is seize the opportunity to bring in a sort of detention centres, closed detention centres, and there were discussions in the Greek Parliament on that this week, but also deliberately ignoring international law. So people are being, they've ended the right to asylum. People are being prevented from arriving. We've had accounts of Greek naval boats with hundreds of refugees sending them back to detention centres on the mainland and then facing deportation. Since March, people are being given a document in a language which they don't understand, which basically says to them they're going to be immediately returned to Turkey. They're going to be detained first and then brought back to Turkey. They're to sign a document which means they'll be registered on a list of unwanted foreigners, which means they go up on the Schengen system and de facto will receive a European Union ban for up to the year 2025. All of this is absolutely illegal, 100% in Greek national law, although they were trying to rectify that, in EU law and in international law. And yet it's happening in the middle of Europe. Now, while obviously I've given out a lot about the Greek government and they are culpable on this, but it's the rest of the European Union who needs to step up into this and immediately relocate people from that island. I mean, it's the same thing as Iran. These people are in an open-air prison now, shortly in some ways going to become more lockdown detention centres, and people are going to die. If there's an outbreak there, God help the people on the island, all of them, the residents and the refugees.
And you mentioned this thing of the number of ICU beds. And when we think of it, we could actually even talk about taps for people to wash their hands. There's not enough taps for people take the most basic precautions.
Even a bed at all, not to mind an ICU bed. There isn't even a bed like, for everybody, or a blanket or anything. It's just... And, you know, MSF and organisations like that had operations with the Greek government where they had practices of urgent transfer of people on medical grounds. They've identified over 140 incredibly acutely vulnerable children who are ill. They're not being transferred off. People over 60 aren't being transferred off. Violence against volunteers. This is just shocking stuff.
Yeah. So it's really proving to be, COVID is proving to be a subterfuge for a number of issues, but it's also the spotlight for issues like you were saying about sanctions and migrants.
You know, the point is that the most vulnerable are being targeted here. Mm. And Ireland has a role to play in this as well. I mean, we welcome the fact that, and I mean, we've been lobbying on this and contacting the minister well before, like months back. So this isn't new. This isn't a crisis caused by COVID-19. And it's not a crisis caused by Turkey opening its borders. It's a crisis that was there long before then. And it's a crisis of the European Union not reforming the Dublin Agreement, these hotspots being allowed to continue, and other member states not adhering to a decent migration pact which would allow people settle in other parts of Europe. And we come back to the point that there's millions of them living in Iran under sanctions and difficult positions, working and getting along fine before COVID, and we in Europe can't take much smaller numbers. Now, the Irish government has agreed to take 36 unaccompanied minors off Greece, which is good. There is some problems around that, but it does put the spotlight on the refugees who did make it to Ireland and those who are stuck in direct provision, for example.
On direct provision, we have a similar conversation happening back home in Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't watch much of Twitter in the last 10 days. It got too bad at home, but the argument about the plight of people living in direct provision it actually, just when they probably need our help the most, people are living in conditions that are very dangerous from a health point of view because of the virus. And we need to actually get them out of it because they're not fit places to be in. But then you have the people saying, well, look, we can't look after our own. Why are we worried about them? Well, you know, it isn't an us or them argument. Mm. I mean, we've got to look after everybody, including those in direct provision. We're not saying that we give anyone preference. We want everyone looked after properly, and people in direct provision are not being looked after properly, and they're living in dire conditions, and now they're at greater risk than ever because of coronavirus. And likewise, Claire mentioned the amount of refugees in Iran, for example. Do you know there was actually 3 million refugees from Afghanistan in Iran, and not living in cages, right, but in general society. But there's reports that in the last 2 weeks, over 100,000 of them have gone back to Afghanistan because of how difficult things have got in Iran, not just because of the sanctions, but now with the spread of the coronavirus as well. And what I mean, none of them are actually even been tested going back. God knows what sort of problems it's going to bring to Afghanistan. But likewise, I mean, for society to function properly anywhere, we've got to care about each other. And if nothing else comes out of this crisis, we've got to rethink how we do things. Mm. We've got to reorganise our societies in a more fair manner. We've got to stop this absolute race to the bottom with neoliberalism and start prioritising the interests of the people before those of big business, because that's what's been happening. And the coronavirus has exposed dramatically the way capitalism works.
Well, it's like the kind of thing we were talking about the other day, like that sick joke in kind of London that the Boris Johnson's government have managed to kind of find accommodation for all of the homeless people in London. Well, begging the question, why didn't they do that before? Now it's only now that they're afraid that they might contaminate some of the few rich people walking by who are out on the streets. But isn't it the case that the most vulnerable live in circumstances whereby actually we can't implement public health measures, because direct provision, you can't segregate. It's the same on the Greek islands. You can't segregate. In Gaza now, some cases have emerged in massively overcrowded areas, homeless people. And it does get to the very heart of how society is organised, what we value and what we don't. But so it's beyond law and morality. Like, it's actually about the functioning of society in its entirety.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, look, in fairness, in Ireland, there has been very strong criticism about the Israelis' behaviour in the West Bank and Gaza and their treatment of the Palestinians. And I would say as well, in fairness to Simon Coveney, as foreign minister, he's been very strong vocally in his opposition to the settlements, which are making a two-state solution impossible in Iran, Palestine, or in Israel and Palestine. But right now, in the last 10 days, Israel has gone into lockdown because of the virus. Well, the people from Gaza are saying they actually love the type of lockdown that's going on in Israel, because they all have shelter, they have access to clean water, they have access to good food. They're still getting some money for their, even if they're out of work. And the Gazans, people in Gaza, the Palestinians, were envying the lockdown, because they've been in lockdown for a long, long time. Gaza is an open prison, and Europe hasn't done enough on that either. And the settlements went on, the expansion of settlements have gone on and on and on and on. And all Israel ever got were little verbal reprimands. We still trade with them. We don't want to trade with Iran or Syria, but we're okay to trade with Israel and Saudi Arabia. Despite the terrible things that both of them get up to, I mean, the lack of consistency in our decision making is nauseating. Mm.
Yeah, so Corona's really proven, though, to be a convenient crisis as you were saying earlier, Claire, about the Greek presidential decree on suspending asylum. But then there's also this side of the data protection as well, and these new measures being rolled out by governments.
Well, I suppose what we're talking about is like we're kind of, the EU is going to be tested. They talk the talk about freedoms and solidarity, but as we were saying earlier, the borders go up when a crisis comes like this. Fundamental rights are suspended because, oh, we can't have that luxury. And then we have some very interesting developments taking place in terms of potential threat to citizens' privacy. Now, I think anybody, and legitimately in the interests of public health, any measure that will help public health would be welcomed by citizens anywhere. So we've had in the last while, whether people know it or not, all across Europe and the world, a massive cooperation between the telecommunications sector exchanging data belonging to mobile phone users with the state. You saw it in China in terms of monitoring people's gatherings and so on. That's been replicated in Europe now through smartphone apps and all the rest. Now, on one level, if it gave a better understanding to health authorities as to where the virus or people who had the virus were located, it might help people alert themselves as to where they might be in terms of an area of danger of transmission and so on. You could see how that might be useful. We see other mechanisms like drones being used to survey the streets in Spain, here in Brussels seemingly. I haven't seen any of them myself, but I believe the drones are monitoring the parks here as well. But the key problem here is the overlap with the private sector and that data. Are people's right to privacy being violated? So if it's anonymised, I don't think people would have any problem with that. But there are some weird things happening. Like if you look at Poland, for example. So the Polish government has developed a home quarantine app for the iPhone and Android. And so the police can basically check on people to make sure they haven't broken their quarantine. So you basically give them your details, your phone number, and then the police send you a message on your phone giving you 20 minutes to take a picture of yourself and send it back, and they'll find out where you are and if you've breached your quarantine. Pretty far-reaching powers, really. And there were attempts in France to bring in to have all authorised telecoms operators been allowed to collect health and location data on all mobile phone users for 6 months, which is really long as well. So look at, I mean, there are potential concerns for the future. The state has been given huge powers, and most citizens would say in the interests of public health, we all agree, but there's huge dangers potentially in that in terms of privacy breaches and how it's used. Because, I mean, you take things like, well, collecting the data, it sounds okay. But that's only okay if everybody's been tested, because how do you know who has it or who doesn't if you haven't tested everybody, which Europe hasn't, like they did in China. And in China at that stage, it hadn't spread that much, so they were able to monitor. But now it's spread so far that location tracking is not really that relevant. So yes, privacy can be curtailed, but it has to be proportionate. It has to be transparent. People have to know about it and be brought along. So I think there could be very there are issues which need to be watched for sure. From a civil liberties point of view going into the future, we should be very careful.
Yeah, look, I mean, we're all in agreement that what was the norm before the coronavirus, some of it can't stay the norm during the crisis, and everything must be done to save lives. But the big fear is that about the aftermath. Where, what will happen? Will things go back? Will we get our rights back? Will we get our freedoms back? I mean, the EU's internal market commissioner, Thierry Breton, only yesterday or the day before, he defended his plan to get telecom firms to hand over mobile phone metadata as part of the battle against coronavirus. The European Data Protection Supervisor, he said that, well, he noted that the EU data regulations were flexible enough to allow for various measures taken in the fight against pandemics. Now, one of the things that has been mentioned is the fact that how bad do we need the location data if everyone is locked up at home and we know where they are anyway? And the European Data Protection Supervisor did caution the Commission about relying on third parties to process the information. He said any private firms dealing with the data should be required to apply the necessary security measures as well as strict confidentiality obligations. I mean, This is a space that we're going to have to watch very carefully when this is all sorted, because very often measures are taken in a crisis. We're able to, we spend years discussing whether we bring in this measure or that. Then we have a crisis. It comes in 24 hours. And you know what? It doesn't always disappear. I mean, look at the Special Criminal Court in Dublin. It was brought in to deal with emergency problems, right? It's still there many, many years later.
Yeah, and it's the thing. I mean, we fought here, like, and we hear morning, noon, night about the Charter of Fundamental Rights and the European Convention on Human Rights, both of which are incredibly important, and both of which actually do allow the possibility of limiting fundamental freedoms in relation to, say, privacy and data protection, if the limitations are lawful, if they pursue a legitimate aim, and obviously public security and public health, everybody would agree, is a legitimate aim, if they're proportionate in a democratic society. And at the moment, everybody agrees that it is proportionate. But we had the other worrying development. So while that's allowed within these charters, we've had six member states actually suspending the charter, saying, oh, we don't need any of that human rights rubbish now here. We're in a crisis. And it's exactly that type of mentality that we need to watch afterwards, because we know that states like to assume power. And as Mick said, with the Special Criminal Court and that, they don't usually like giving it back when they get it. So we do need to be careful that this is done lawfully, that it's done carefully, and that the minds of the public, that this isn't allowed to be snuck in behind the scenes. And look at all the data that the private companies have and are given to the state. Very, very worrying.
Yeah. So that's it. We need to be vigilant. We need to watch what the developments we've seen, and very reminiscent of the war on terror. The effects of that are still with us. The measures are still in place, really. So we need to look at these kind of shock moments and crisis in our society and how we react afterwards. And same thing with goes to when we're talking about austerity measures after this and the economic downturn. So we absolutely need to be vigilant. So today you've heard from us about sanctions, you've heard from us about Greek islands, a bit on data, and about solidarity within the EU and outside. So we hope you liked it, but please like, subscribe, share, and give us a rating on our podcasts. You don't need to send us any money. There's no Patreon account. This is completely free. But do give us a nice comment or a rating and get in touch with us for any topics you'd like us to talk about. So that's it from us. Take care, wash your hands, and stay safe.